Conservatism, an Obituary, Q&A with Ayn Rand.
Let me begin as usual by asking Miss Rand a few of the questions which have come in the mail. Here's one. How would one defend enlightened individualism when posed against the overwhelming evidence that man is a social, that is a gregarious animal, and this herd feeling would support collective altruism in order to survive? The historical evidence seems to support some form of collectivism. For example, the need to control natural disasters such as ill health, the weather, and the economic cycle by government means.
Now, to begin with, this questioner indicates that he has not yet read my books, and I would have to refer to my books for a full answer to every part of this question. To indicate my answer only briefly, it is a totally unwarranted assumption that man is a social, that is, gregarious animal, and that there is any sort of herd feeling to support altruism. If you mean simply that man is a being which finds great advantage in living in society, that is true. However, you will observe that only by being free can a man live in society peacefully and profitably. When you attempt to subordinate the individual to the herd, then all history will show you why this is the improper, the unnatural, and the destructive way for men to live. History demonstrates, more than any other particular discipline, the fact that man is not a herd animal. Namely, all the horrors of history, all the worst periods of tyranny, slavery, and stagnation correspond to those periods when man's political system was collectivistic. And all the periods of progress are due to the suspension or the temporary relief from collectivist or herd pressures and the freedom given to the individual, namely, as an example, ancient Greece, the Renaissance, the 19th century. For a modern example, look at West Germany and East Germany to decide which form of existence, the cooperative freedom of individuals or the collectivist force and the subordination of the individual to the collective, which of these two works better, which is proper to men. As to your last question, you seem to confuse what you call natural disasters with the man-made disasters. For instance, ill health, weather, and economic cycles. Economic cycles are not a result of nature. And incidentally, economic cycles are not an inherent flaw of capitalism. If by the cycle you mean the periods of boom and depression, these cycles are caused by government interference into the economy. Therefore, they are the result of the policy of collectivism. As to such disasters as ill health, nothing can do anything about them except scientific discoveries. So that is, if you want to combat ill health, that's one of the issues, if we have a choice, where the freedom of the individual mind is most necessary.
Here's a somewhat similar question from another listener who asks, isn't altruism forced on society by the machine age and by overproduction in the agricultural field, overproduction in the industrial field, and developments in the field of medicine?
Well, the error in this question is that altruism is a philosophical ethical system. A philosophical ethical system cannot be forced on man by events or by certain social phenomena. The relationship works the other way around. The philosophical or moral theory that men hold results in certain social events and is the cause, not the effect of this event. Now, you also include here a very great fallacy, namely the idea that overproduction is inherent in the machine age. Overproduction is a colloquial term very loosely used and it has no specific meaning, because what is usually caused overproduction is the phenomenon that are depressions taking place periodically under capitalism. Well, they're not caused by overproduction in the sense that they are necessitated by the machine age or by the operation of capitalism. Depressions are caused by government interference into the economy, more specifically by government manipulation of credit. Now, the power given to that to the government, or rather the cause of the power given to the government, is the altruist morality. If men believe that it is the duty and the right of some men to force others for the sake of relieving still others, that's the idea of altruism, which permits government interference into economic activities and therefore creates what is loosely called overproduction. Now, the machine age is not a mysterious phenomenon somehow imposed on men. What do we mean by the machine age? We mean the Industrial Revolution, the discovery of machines as the main tool of production. Well, that was caused by political freedom, relative political freedom at the beginning of the 19th century, the end of the 18th, and a rational, individualistic view of man and of man's right, of man's rights. That is what created the machine age, and without an individualistic and rational system of society, mankind will not keep its machines for very long. For further illustration of that, read my novel Atlas Shrugged, or a very short novelette, Anthem, which I think will tell you why you will not have any sort of machine age so long as you have a society based on altruism. Therefore, there is no overproduction in the agricultural field, in the industrial field. Any dislocations are in those fields are due to government interference into the economy and cannot lead to men accepting an altruist or any moral idea. It's the wrong moral idea, altruism, that leads to that interference. Certainly you made a slight mistake here. You cannot say an overproduction in the field of medicine and old age. The fact that men grow old and that they need medical care is more argument for the necessity of leaving them free to produce, not for the necessity to sacrifice some men to others.
One brief question from another reader. Can a good objectivist participate in a freedom ride?
Now, if this question meant to ask a wider principle, what is the objectivist attitude towards race prejudice or race discrimination, then I would answer emphatically that objectivists object, that they are opposed to race prejudice and discrimination of any kind on the most fundamental ground. Such prejudice is a contradiction of individual rights. Objectivism claims that each man is an individual and has to be judged on his own record, not assigned to some collective and judged collectively. More than that, racial prejudice rests on the premise that man is determined by his physical body, that his character is determined by his race. In other words, he inherits certain mental and spiritual characteristics which over which he has no power. Nothing could be further removed from objectivism, because such a premise denies the validity, the importance, or even the existence of man's mind as the source of his character, as that faculty of man which determines his values, his character, and all of the life of his consciousness, as opposed to his body. Race prejudice is the lowest, most primitive form of collectivism. It is the collectivism of, in effect, a stock farm, and it treats men as if they were brood animals. Again, nothing could be more opposed to objectivism. And a final point. As I have said in one of my lectures, the smallest minority on earth is the individual. Since objectivists support individual rights, they would therefore certainly support minority rights. But the opposite is also true. Modern collectivists who pretend to be the champions of minority could not possibly succeed at protecting minorities since they deny the rights of the individual. The contradiction is theirs. Now, as to the specific part of your question, it is not the sort of question that one can answer briefly because it includes many practical, specific question marks. Who organized a freedom ride, in what form, on whose property? Therefore, the concrete application of the general principle or of the issue, how do we fight racial discrimination, must be answered only in general terms. We can fight it only when and if, in that fight, we do not infringe anyone's individual property rights.
One final question from the mails. It seems to have been discussed last week in the program, although it's been sent in since then. It reads as follows. When you claim that a free society requires a government-controlled police force supported by compulsory taxes, have you not destroyed the objective validity of your premise that the best government is one that imposes no restrictions on the individual's freedom? In admitting this one exception, are you not in effect saying that government control is a matter of degree in your system? To be consistent with the rest of your view, would not even the police force and the courts of law have to be privately owned?
Certainly not. As Professor Haspers mentions, this question has been answered in great detail, or an equivalent question, on a preceding broadcast, so that I will remind this questioner, only in case he hasn't heard it, that we, none of us objectivists, have ever said that we approve of compulsory taxation. Let me state briefly, because I have no time now for a long technical discussion on this subject, that in the kind of ideal societies that objectivists advocate as the ultimate and proper political goal of a society, there would be no such thing as compulsory taxation. Taxes would be contributed voluntarily, and it would be workable and possible because any government service which people in fact need, they will support. And there are theories promulgated as to how one would work a system of free voluntary taxation. However, this is a very premature part of our consideration because voluntary taxation would be the last step in the evolution of a totally free society, not the first, and certainly not anything that one can foresee in the immediate future. As to why the government has to have a monopoly on the police or the law courts, well, the issue here really is the nature of the use of physical force and the nature of objectivity. The purpose of government is the protection of individuals against force. Therefore, the government itself has the exclusive right to retaliate by force against those citizens or foreign countries that initiate the use of force. And the government's retaliation is subject to the most strict and objective laws. The government cannot retaliate arbitrarily or at whim, that is, in a free society. The government is the agency to which we delegate our right of self-defense and limit the government's use of this right by strict laws, so that the use of force, even retaliatory force, is not left up to the whim of any one individual. This is why it is the proper monopoly of government to use force in retaliation under law. Therefore, I would suggest that before you accuse us of contradictions, you better define and think out your terms more carefully.
Let me turn to another question. This is a fairly brief one, but it's taken right from the text of your talk last week, Ms. Rand. Is it for reasons of altruistic self-sacrifice that we give away money to foreign countries?
Well, the answer is yes and no on two different levels. The most fundamental issue here is, yes, it is altruism that is used as the justification for giving money away to foreign countries, and therefore it is altruism that makes people accept this policy. It is altruism that is given as the reason why we should support undeveloped countries. If you ask me, is altruism the actual motive of those who advocate and put into practice that policy, then I would say no. But first, let us take the theoretical part. Even on the theoretical part, there is a blatant contradiction in the arguments offered by the defenders of aid to foreign countries. On the one hand, we are told a purely altruistic argument, namely that it is our moral duty for some unstated reason to support every backward nation or any nation which does not have our standard of living and progress. On the other hand, we are also told simultaneously that if we don't help these nations, which are helpless at present, they will become a threat to us in the future. Now you can see the contradiction. If certain countries are a threat to us, then we certainly shouldn't help them to develop further and threaten us more effectively. If they are not a threat to us, then the only possible excuse would be the altruistic premise that it is our moral duty to destroy and drain ourselves for the sake of other nations which have not reached our level of progress. Now, this is the theoretical base of foreign aid. But now, on the other side of the question, that is, if your question implies, is it the true motivation of those who have put that policy into practice and who are administering it politically, then I would say no. It may be their theoretical excuse, but what we can observe in action is that there are certain groups that profit by this policy. Which groups are they? The type of businessman with political pull and the type of politician who does him favors, who make a thriving business out of dealing with the foreign countries that receive our aid. In effect, the pattern is as follows. If a foreign country needs, let us say, a new water power or water installations, some American company will make arrangements with the government of that country that when they get American aid, the government will buy all the needed equipment for this project from this particular American company. In other words, what in my book Atlas Shrugged I call the aristocracy of pull is the real motivation or situation that keeps going the whole issue of foreign aid. There are the types of mixed economy businessmen, the men with special political favors or pull, who have a vested interest in seeing American money go to foreign governments and then come back into their own pockets. It is almost as if they were literally taking money out of other American citizens' pockets and taking it. It is an inexact way of, indirect way rather, to make a profit on American taxes. And I would say practically it would be cheaper and it would be clearer morally if they simply took it out of our pockets. But there is no more revolting phenomenon of a mixed economy than the semi-free enterpriser, the mixed economy businessman who has special laws, special subsidy passed, and who makes private profit out of public taxation. He is a legalized robber who is taking it out of the wealth and the effort of other citizens. That is the practical motivation which would permit so insane a policy to be kept going. If it were not for men of that kind, if someone attempted this policy on purely theoretical ground, he would find out very quickly why it doesn't work and why it achieves the exactly opposite result of that intended. The foreign aid giveaways neither help the recipient country nor profit us in any sense. They merely drain our economy and help mixed economies in other countries, since they are not given as private funds for private investment, but merely help to keep a particular government, foreign government, in power, since they are given to a foreign government. This is not the way to attempt or even to hope to establish a free system in a foreign country. And the result to our country is certainly disastrous. But now, what could possibly permit anyone to hope that such a policy would be accepted? Only the morality of altruism. Only the idea that we are supposed in some way to feel guilty if someone else is poorer or less fortunate than we are, and that it is our duty to sacrifice everything to help him, whether he's an individual or a nation. Therefore, I consider foreign aid as the archetypical example of the United States of America destroying itself in the name of altruism.
Let me turn to another question. A student from one of the new countries of Africa said to me that in his country, a few people control all the land, and they force extremely high rents from the tenants, who then can't do anything about it. What he wants to know is, shouldn't the government intervene in such a situation? Shouldn't there be some kind of land reform to keep this hereditary class from continuing to enjoy these privileges which they have not earned? Or would objectivism simply favor a continuation of the status quo?
Well, objectivism is a political philosophy. It will not advocate specific rules for each individual country and say this is part of objectivism. It isn't proper to ask an objectivist policy on a particular and unnamed country. Therefore, let us make the question wider. Would the question consist in the fact of the following? What would be the objectivist position on the question of a country's transition from some non-free, non-capitalist society to capitalism? Is that what the question really means? Because if the situation is as the questioner describes it, one small group of landed gentry could not get hold of that land and could not get into that position under free capitalism, therefore it must have obtained it under some form of statism or another. But now, I assume the government wants to free the people. Is this, in effect, the situation described as a sample?
Yes.
Well, if a country established a really free, laissez-faire capitalist government patterned, in essence, on the government originally established in the United States, namely, a government based on the respect for and charged with the duty to protect individual rights, a government which would then guarantee property rights and non-interference in anyone's economic effort. If a country established this kind of government, they would break up this land monopoly in very short order. But here is the important distinction. If a liberating government starts by seizing someone else's property, it will not go very far towards freedom because it has already established the premise that the government or the collective own all the property in this country and have the right to dispose of it. Therefore, if they start on that contradiction, they will collapse into another and worse form of slavery very quickly. If, however, they establish a real, laissez-faire, a government, and history will illustrate this process, what will happen to the landowners is that the pressure of industrial development will force them either to sell their land or to go broke, more specifically. The poor people or the agricultural laborers on this particular island or in that society will either move away because they're free to move away, or, and more importantly, the more enterprising among them will start small industries of their own. Any country in which the government guarantees property rights will immediately attract investors from other countries who, if they see hard-working, free, prosperous, or semi-prosperous people, likely to be prosperous, who will invest in the development of industries on this island or in this new country. The landowners who do nothing with their land except try to work it by primitive agricultural methods will see their land depreciating as against the growing wealth of those who go into industry, and they will be forced either to use their land productively or sell it or lose their fortune by its depreciation. When I say forced, I mean this here only metaphorically, of course. I mean the force of circumstances, not the compulsion of any law. This, incidentally, in essence, is the manner by which the rise of capitalism broke up the feudal estates, the inherited and even entailed land properties. Observe, in America, nothing is left today of the on the west coast of the original Spanish land grants. The pressure of industry put them on the market. In England, where the estates are entailed, most of the landowners are broke or semi-broke and financially very helpless, which is caused by the fact that you cannot hang on to land uneconomically in disregard of the market process in a free or even a semi-free economy. So as a practical advice to this young student, if he has a particular country in mind, I would say, if you want to liberate the people, advocate total laissez-faire capitalism, not a worse form of collectivism than the one they had before.
There's not much more time and a great many more questions that we could ask, but let me ask this one. The brief question, not a brief answer. What do you think of the current conservative groups in this country, specifically the Young Americans for Freedom?
We are totally opposed to them, as they are to us. The Young Americans for Freedom are a group dominated by the philosophy in effect represented by National Review magazine. It is not that National Review runs them, I do not know the connection, but it is that kind of philosophical direction. Young Americans for Freedom are guilty in various degrees of all the arguments which I listed in my lecture of last week, where I stated why we consider these arguments disastrous to capitalism or to any defenders of capitalism. Therefore, it is the basic philosophy of the Young Americans for Freedom which is ineffectual and worse than ineffectual, that it will not really achieve freedom or defend capitalism, but more by the weak stand, by the unintellectual program, the lack of basic principle or of any valid philosophy, they are merely helping the enemies of capitalism to discredit it. I understand, at least from hearsay, that many young people who are admirers of my books or of objectivism join Young Americans for Freedom simply out of a desire to take some practical action. I strongly recommend to such young people as do agree with my ideas not to do it. There can be no rapprochement, no middle of the ground between my philosophy and that of the YAFs, as they're called, Young Americans for Freedom. And young people interested in both should make a choice. It's either or. The two cannot be combined.
Does the same apply to the political candidate who is most often associated with objectivism, Senator Goldwater?
Well, not the same, really. No, he's not yet, and I hope not, guilty of the same theoretical and other evils of which I accuse the YAFs. But I have a very mixed view of Senator Goldwater for the reason that his own views are mixed. Namely, he is not an advocate of laissez-faire capitalism. He is an advocate of a mixed economy, but in a far lesser degree than any other so-called conservative today. So it's only a matter of degree, and I disagree with him very strongly on that. In his first book, I agreed with him thoroughly on his foreign policy. I think his stand on that was magnificent. I understand he has a new book out, but I have not yet read it and cannot judge it. So all I would have to say on Senator Goldwater is that my estimate of him is as follows. At the moment, as of this moment, he seems to be the best of the conservative potential candidates for leadership, but one cannot know which way he will develop, since he has been guilty of many contradictions, and one would have to watch his future development very carefully.
For additional information about other available programs, please contact Second Renaissance at 1-800-729-6149 or at www.ayanrandbookstore.com. All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before an audience, without the express written permission of the producer, Second Renaissance Incorporated.